A new generation severs the post-World War II social contract in the Mideast. Washington redefines the value of a human life. A Republican governor rejects hemming and hawing and starts real budget cutting. And a computer beats humans at their own game. I'm Jane Bornemeyer. We'll take a look at these stories and more on the front page of Thursday's New York Times. Protests convulsed half a dozen countries across the Middle East on Wednesday, from Bahrain to Libya, Yemen to Iran. On the one hand, each protest was inspired by a distinctive set of national circumstances and issues. They range from dire poverty and the lack of jobs to ethnic and religious differences, minority rule, corruption, or questions of economic status. But there was also a pervasive sense that a shared system of poor governance rule by one party, one family, or one clique of military officers backed up by brutal secret police is collapsing. A new generation has served notice that the social contract in play in the decades since independence around World War II was no longer valid. What is the value of a human life? Washington wants to know. The answer determines how much government agencies should spend on regulation and how much of the cost should be shared by the businesses they regulate. The dollars are rising, and that's a sensitive issue for the Obama administration, which is trying to be a friend of business. For example, the Environmental Protection Agency set the value of a life at $9.1 million last year when it proposed tighter regulations on air pollution. That's up from $6.8 million during the George W. Bush administration. In another example, the Food and Drug Administration declared that a life was worth $7.9 million last year, up from $5 million in 2008. That's when it proposed that warning labels on cigarette packages feature images of cancer victims. And the Transportation Department has used values of around $6 million to justify several recent decisions to impose regulations that the Bush administration had rejected as too expensive, like requiring stronger roofs on cars. A computer has beaten human beings at their own game. The computer would be Watson. The game would be Jeopardy. In a two-day tournament of sorts, the IBM computer defeated two of Jeopardy's finest players, demonstrating the power of computers to sort out information and answer specific questions. The Times' John Markoff put it this way.
Well, Watson won because it had this encyclopedic knowledge and also had the ability to understand natural language to a really remarkable degree.
And what does the demonstration mean for the future of computing, to say nothing of the future of human beings?
Think about how many people make a living from answering questions or performing transactions, commercial transactions over the telephone. All those jobs are at risk.
A communications gap once kept U.S. troops on deployment from being distracted by all those messy details of home life. But being out of the loop is now out of the question. Cell phones, internet access, and social networking sites like Facebook help troops in combat zones communicate with the home front nearly 24/7. They can partake in births and birthdays in real time. They can check sports scores, take online college courses, and even manage businesses and stock portfolios. Pretty awesome, right? Well, yes, but there's a flip side. Some commanders worry that the rank and file are being burdened by problems like faulty dishwashers and unpaid electric bills, wayward kids and failing relationships, when they should be thinking about their own safety. Events in Wisconsin this week are a sign that budgetary boldness might be taking hold in state houses across the country. Uncowed by angry state workers, the newly elected Republican Governor Scott Walker is forging ahead with plans to cut some of their benefits and curtail collective bargaining rights. It's all in the name of fiscal austerity and budgetary constraints. Until now, state officials around the country have been apologetic and half-hearted when it comes to state and local budget cuts. But if boldness works in Wisconsin, experts think it will be emulated by Republicans in other financially wobbly states. And finally, halfway around the world from Cairo's Tahrir Square, an aging American intellectual shuffles about his cluttered brick row house in a working-class neighborhood in Boston, Massachusetts. His name is Gene Sharp. Stoop-shouldered and white-haired at 83, he grows orchids, has yet to master the internet, and hardly seems like a dangerous man. But for the world's despots, his ideas can be fatal. Few Americans have ever heard of Mr. Sharp, but for decades, his practical writings on nonviolent revolution have inspired dissidents from Burma to Bosnia, Estonia to Zimbabwe, and now Tunisia and Egypt. His most popular written work, From Dictatorship to Democracy, is a 93-page guide to toppling autocrats. It's available for download in 24 languages. It has circulated for years in Egypt and Tunisia, where governments have recently fallen. Mr. Sharp takes no credit except to say that his works might have offered some encouragement. And that's a preview of the front page of Thursday's New York Times. For more on these and other stories, pick up a copy of the paper or go to nytimes.com. From the New York Times newsroom, I'm Jane Bornemeyer.